Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
We are back, and now joining us, author Douglas Burchell. Thank you for joining us in the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay. Now, your new book coming out here November 5th, Harvesting Shadows. Let's tell the audience a little bit about what that is.
Okay. Well, this is a novel. This is a story that details the experiences that one family, I would say, endured during their time in a haunted house in Salt Lake City. But I think to call it a haunted house is almost, it's, I would say those people were victimized by whatever was in the house. And this is me telling their story. They hired me basically to document what they remembered and to bring it to life, I guess is the best.
Best way to describe it. So to speak.
As it were.
And let's start with you. Now, tell us a little bit about you. Where did Douglas start? How did you get into this? And how did they find you to write this or to talk about this?
Well, I've been a freelance writer for about 10 years now. And I started off writing articles, short stories, you know, press releases and kind of video game reviews. I ended up working for Frogwares game development studio for about, I'd say, 5 or 6 years. All telecommute. They're a Ukrainian-based company. And when the civil war in Ukraine happened or the Russians invaded, you know, however you want to look at it, that was kind of the end of that. So I bummed around for a bit until my wife said, "You got to start doing something or you're going to go crazy." And I thought, yeah, you're right. I can pretty much do whatever I want now. And I've always had an interest in the paranormal ever since I was a child. And oddly enough, I just started, you know, Googling and checking the job boards on the off chance that somebody was looking for somebody to tell their story. It was really weird. And I happened upon April had posted a job post on Elance, and I checked it out, and I thought, you know, I'm going to try this one. I'm going to go for it. And I ended up coming in at the tail end. She was down to like the last three writers that she was going to choose. They're all like very technical, very good writers. And I told her, I said, I'm going to come at this. I'm going to basically frame this in the form that I would write my fiction. And I guess it really struck a chord with her family, because I tried to put myself in their shoes, you know, and understand, you know, their situation. So I submitted my writing sample, and it ended up being the one they went with. And it was pretty much a wild ride from there.
Right. So now you say you sort of had a belief in paranormal since you were young. Did you have any actual experiences, or did you just sort of find it interesting?
Both. I'd always found it interesting, and I've seen things, you know what I mean? Like, the most memorable one that sticks out in my memory is a large shadow entity one night as I was driving home. And you hear people talk about these things when you read other people's experiences about something being so dark it absorbs the ambient light. And this thing was so dark it absorbed the light of my headlights. I mean, I'd come to a dead stop in the street, and this thing slowly just passed, floated right in front of me. Had to be at least 8 feet tall. And it was so unreal that, I mean, that was from that moment I started reading authors like John Keel, you know, Jacques Vallée, Barry Taff, some guys who are like kind of exploring other avenues other than the traditional, you know, because it didn't look like a ghost to me. It didn't look like a demon, but it was definitely some kind of thing that was out of place. And that was probably about, I'd say, 15 years ago. And that's when I started looking into some of this stuff a little more seriously.
Right. So now this story here, when you first got it, like when you were first being told about it, so, you know, we hear a lot of stories, you know, in pop culture and around the world now about hauntings and paranormal and all that. It's just going on, right?
Right.
How did you come to the point where you thought this was real? Like, was there a turning point? I mean, because, you know, I get hundreds a day.
And
there has to be a point when you're reading and you're kind of going, oh, okay, well, maybe not.
Yeah.
You know, where did it turn?
At first, honestly, I was convinced they were lying to me. We've had this discussion, April and Matt and I, because there was a point where they actually asked me, you know, like, do you believe this? Do you believe what we're telling you? And in the beginning, like I said, I thought they had to be lying. They had to be making this up, or maybe, you know, they were all sharing some kind of delusion. But then I started interviewing the other folks that had been involved in this, like the paranormal researcher and the clairvoyant. I started looking up the real estate records and, you know, finding obituaries and stuff. And I started to say, well, you know, if they had made this up, it's been 10 years. You know, they could have written a book three times over. They wouldn't need me to tell the story. So things started clicking into place. And there were some other things that began to happen as I was working on this story. As I got deeper and deeper into it, I'd be interviewing April or Matt on the phone. And, you know, my brother lives out in Seattle, and I talked to him quite a bit on the phone, too. He lives out in Washington State, and I get no interference, you know what I mean? Like, they don't even live that far out, and I was getting, I don't know if it was interference or what it was, but these screaming, animalistic voices that started to mask their voices to the point where I couldn't even understand what they were saying anymore, and I had to tell them to stop. And that happened a few times. And you know, I got to the point where I started to worry, like, is this a safe project to actually be working on? Because it seems to be still somewhat active, or there's something connected to the story, or it's getting into my head somehow. And, you know, one night I was up late, and I was worrying about this kind of stuff out on the back porch, and I was just thinking, like, what if something like this came after my family, what would I be able to do? And it was really weird, almost like as if an answer, there was, like, three bright blue flashes of light that seemed to come out of nowhere and lit up the backyard just like it was the middle of the day. And like all of a sudden, you know, when people say that all of a sudden I had that feeling I wasn't alone, you know what I mean? Like I had that feeling and I was like, okay, all right. So either this, you know, appears to all be real or I'm stressing myself out or it's a product of my overactive imagination.
Yeah.
At any rate, I decided, you know, I had to keep this story at arm's length. I believe, you know, what they told me.
There's always that point, right? Because I mean, you get a lot.
Oh, sure,
of,
sure.
You know, so now this is in Salt Lake City, is it in the actual city or in the suburbs?
It's in a place called the Avenues, which is right. It's not far from downtown Salt Lake City. And it's where some of the oldest houses in Salt Lake are, where some of the original settlers, you know, began to build their, you know, the more wealthy ones began to build their mansions. And, you know, from what I'm told, there's just about, they say just about every old house up there has some kind of activity. And there's some speculation that maybe the entire area is a nexus of some kind. Maybe, you know, like if you believe in ley lines, that one maybe runs through that particular area. But it's something about the avenues that just seems to have, you know, these stories.
Right. Well,
some,
you know,
kind of activity.
But that's kind of a, I mean, that is a fairly Mormon populated area.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't really... I have some Mormon in my background, but there's not really a belief in afterlife per se like that, where there's ghosts and hauntings.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So does that affect them in the community itself? Like you know what I'm saying? If you're in the middle of a district that's got, you know, a fairly popular type of, you know, whatever it is, it's a Mormon religion or any other type of thing, and you're kind of talking out of turn, so to speak. You're saying, well, this is, did that put pressure on them is what I'm sort of saying. Like if you're, like how do their neighbors feel?
Well, the interesting thing about the avenues is, you know, it started out very Mormon, but it became, by the time Matt and April were living there, it was a bit more, I don't know what you use, bohemian, I guess.
Yeah, okay.
You know, it wasn't unusual to see people drinking wine, you know, on a Sunday morning on their porch.
Right.
The missionaries didn't really go up that way because I think it had kind of become home to a new crowd. In fact, there's a Masonic temple up around there, as I recall from what they were telling me. But it's, yeah, they're, as far as you know, the Mormon population, some of the things in the book, you know, like in April's early life, you see, like, you know, the bishop laying hands on her, but they didn't really go that direction as far as like seeking too much help, you know, towards the end of this from the Mormon community.
Right. No, I was just wondering because I know what it's like. And I was just wondering if it put a pressure on them to behave a certain way, you know?
Right. Well, I know, and you know, April's mother was very concerned about the way they were living their lives at that point because of what was going on in the house. So there was some pressure, at least from, you know, the family angle. But, yeah, community-wise, I think they both worked so much that they didn't have a real good chance to get to know their neighbors that well until, you know, they started going around and asking questions.
Okay. And so so how did it start for them? Let's kind of go through the scenario. When did they move there, and what was the first thing that they noticed that was different?
Well, when they moved in, it sounds kind of cliched, but, you know, these things, they start slowly, you know, shadow out of the corner of your eye, you think you hear noises, you know, strange dreams. but it began to build with starting to hear the banging on the pipes, you know, stuff you can initially write off. It's an old house, you know what I mean? They make noise until, you know, you begin to, the banging on the pipes almost seems to have an intelligence behind it. You know, you start to hear these children's voices at night, and you start to pick up on it that it's not, it's not coming from the neighbor's house or outside or anything, you know, and your own kids aren't home. But I think the real turning point was when they began to see this symbol on the ceiling in their bedroom, you know, this kind of like figure eight that swirled in this pattern. And again, there, you know, we have this phenomenon of, you know, this thing, whatever it is, being darker than dark, you know. You can see it in the darkness, you know, because it's absorbing, like I said before, you know, like the ambient light. You can tell that there's something there. And they, you know, they eventually came to this conclusion that, you know, maybe this house was haunted by a little kid, you know. And they, I don't think they would disagree that, you know, it's a good example of what not to do, you know, trying to deal with this stuff by yourself, looking up remedies on the internet. But they did. They read it up, you know, right up. They went down to the Golden Braid bookstore, and they attempted to banish this thing on their own. And it worked, but unfortunately, it would appear that this symbol was actually a ward of some kind of keeping things in check. And once they forced it out of the house, literally when all hell broke loose, and things just went, you know, over the edge.
Yeah. And so what was their predisposition? So where were they feeling in far as, were they religious? Were they, did they have a background with paranormal and they believed in ghosts and that kind of, where did they come from in that framework?
April was interested in it. You know, she kind of had an interest in the paranormal also from a younger age, but it may have been part of rebellion against, you know, her Mormon upbringing.
Right.
But Matt was pretty down to earth. Like, he was more of a technology kind of guy. You had to show him something for him to believe in it. And like he didn't go out of his way to disprove things either. He kind of had a fairly open mind, but he didn't let himself get wrapped up in concepts of the paranormal. In fact, when this stuff started happening, he was more of the mind that, you know, we should just deal with this ourselves. We don't need to get anyone else involved. We don't need to become a spectacle. You know, have people all around town talking about it. So he was definitely also a very protective man. You know, he didn't want to expose his family to, you know, like a parade of charlatans and ghosts, you know, people right. who are, we know there are people out there looking to make a dime off of people, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, how do you know who to trust?
Exactly.
Yeah.
He didn't want to open his family up to that.
No. Did they have children at the time?
April had two sons, Nate and Shane, from previous relationships. And Matt, you know, she had met Matt a couple of years earlier, and they had decided to, you know, try this family thing together. And things had been working out pretty well. They were at a point where they could financially afford, you know, this nice Victorian home with some remodeling and some, you know, rebuilding. And things were looking pretty bright when they moved in.
And so, now, it sounds like it was pretty terrifying. So after the, you know, the pipes banging and some voices, when did this, something major start happening that where it became a little bit more desperate, a little bit more terrifying for them?
April's mother had come over to stay one night while Matt was out of town on a contract, and April had asked her mother to come over, help out, get the boys to school and stuff like that. And she had set up a cot in the youngest boy's room, Shane. And over the course of the night, his closet door kept opening. And, you know, again, that's something you can kind of write off to a gusty home or, you know, an older place. But at some point, something reached out of the closet and grabbed her arm. And she had to shake it off. And that was when things got a little bit more intense, you know, like people started taking it a little bit more seriously. That was, you know, not long after that, they started to notice that symbol. And the questions that the possibility that, you know, maybe somebody's going to get hurt if we don't do something about this. But then on the other hand, you know, you're kind of stuck in this mentality, but, you know, this stuff isn't supposed to happen, you know, right?
Yeah. Was there any significance to the symbol of eight? Like you were saying, that symbol, did they come up with anything? Or?
That seemed to be a symbol, you know, symbol for infinity. So the best that they could guess was that it was a ward, a protective symbol of some kind that someone had put there. And that was a best guess, you know, because the entire phenomenon is not just in this case, but it seems to be open to a lot of subjection, you know what I mean?
Right.
A haunting, this experience, one of the things I noticed working on this project, it becomes an intensely personal thing, this experience that you go through, almost as if, you know, and I'm just speculating here, this is just something that, you know, I had thought about, like, if it's, perhaps it's meant to teach a lesson, or it's meant to open your worldview, or it's somehow reflects your subconscious in some way. So, I mean, it's so hard to tell, you know, in retrospect. It could have had a lot of meaning. It could have been, you know, this symbol for infinity. It could have been something else. But that's the other thing. There's no definite, real definite answers as to what exactly it was.
Now, I've noticed now your name, Harvesting Shadows. Where did that come from?
Actually, April came up with that. We were kicking around some ideas and kind of brainstorming different ideas. And Harvesting Shadows seemed to just hit the nail right on the head as far as what had happened in this house, you know, concerning what they believed the source of this haunting had been, which was, you know, this family of polygamists that had lived there in the 30s. And was led by, you know, this man William, who was just very vile and cruel man, and it seemed like that's what he had done there. He had kind of like planted misery, and now, you know, it was time people were harvesting the shadows that had been left behind by his abuse of his own family.
Family of polygamists. So how did they determine that? Was this a sort of research, or was there, you mentioned clairvoyant earlier. Did they bring something like that in, or a medium?
Mm-hmm. They had so many come through the house, and, you know, they just seemed to be making it up as they went along. But one in particular, Debbie, seemed to home in on what they had experienced already. And when she toured the house, you know, she told them that's what she saw. She saw this family of polygamists and other relations that they had brought into the house, and that this man was very abusive towards his children, towards other people's children, towards his own wives. And that was the general feel that they got. This guy seemed to have a lot of power. And I guess at the time, in the 30s, some polygamist families, I know it had been outlawed by the church state well before that, but some of them almost operated like organized crime families, as I understand it. And So it would seem that what she saw seemed to, you know, fit the bill for what was going on here. But again, the phenomenon, you know, like my own personal point of view, I believe something happened in that house. You know, and even amongst the other people who experienced it, you know, there's some question as to what the nature of the phenomenon actually is. Does it pick up on what you expect it to be? Or does it feed you what it is, you know, and then you pick up on these elements? There again, that's another, you know, big mystery of it.
Yeah. You know, so they must have researched it some as well.
Mm-hmm.
Did the people before them that lived there, were they able to contact them and see kind of what they experienced? Or?
Well, that's actually a very tragic tale there. The husband who had lived in that house before they had moved in killed himself, and he left a very disturbing suicide note painted on the wall of the hallway, which said, "This house murdered me." And when they started doing a little more research, talking to the neighbors, they found that a lot of the behaviors that Matt had been exhibiting as you know, this phenomenon got worse, were the same things that the previous owner had done. You know, standing outside, screaming at the house at all hours of the night, personality changes, just this feeling of fighting a losing battle. They had some limited contact with his wife. She stopped by one day, and she just, tales had been going around the town, you know what I mean? Like people, yeah. You know, well, that's the haunted house over there. And she had stopped by one day and talked to Matt, and you know, she asked him, you know, you don't think it's my husband, do you? And he said, no, you know, the last thing he wanted to do was open up old wounds or anything like that. But they're, yeah, so the immediate, you know, the occupants immediately before them had some kind of, you know, some kind of bizarre activity going on in the house as well.
Yeah, yeah.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And so, they started talking to the neighbors, you said. So now, mm-hmm. have the neighbors found anything unusual about the house or about their own house in the same area?
Not too much in a lot of the houses in the area. Now, when the paranormal researchers were in Matt Maple's house for a while, they, an interesting side story, they got a visit from one of the guys at the Masonic Temple one night. And the guy came, had come down, and he was asking, like, you guys are the ghost researchers, you know, and they were just kind of like telling him a little bit about what was going on. And he said, you got to come up to the temple sometime and see what's going on. So that would lead you to believe that there's something else going on up there as well.
And so now this has kind of gotten into where you say, now there's aspects of violence throughout this. What were some of the violent things that happened in the house after the initial little things that were happening?
When it really started cutting loose, I guess, was it seemed to react directly to being provoked. There were a couple instances where Matt was challenging one of these entities that he had seen repeatedly, and it was kind of like these you hear a lot about these shadow people, the Hat Man, and he there was one incident where, you know, he kind of challenged anything that was in the house, you know, telling it to get out, and he ended up just getting knocked across the kitchen, you know, while he was pouring coffee, the whole coffee maker, the mug, everything, just everybody would just went slamming against the wall. And there was one particular incident when April was assaulted by something, you know, after work one night. She had come home. She was getting ready for bed. She noticed the shadow kind of like flittering around the staircase. And by the time she had turned around, this thing had knocked her down the stairs. And these particular entities seemed to have an ability, I don't know if it's a need, but they seem to drain people's strength. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like I said, that's another like wild card there. You know, I don't know if it, like I said, if it was a need or if it was just like a dominance kind of thing. But so there were a couple incidents where, you know, the phenomenon was becoming more and more violent. And it's probably important to note, at least from my perspective, that the more afraid they became, the more violent it became, the stronger it seemed to become. So it was, you know, the shadows would be reaching out and strangling April in a couple incidences, slamming the bed around. Their youngest son, they believe that at one point was strangled by one of these entities as well. And it all seems to be this kind of snowball effect. You know, the more afraid you become of it, the more powerful it becomes, the more dangerous it becomes. So I don't know if I'm sure there's clues in there somewhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so did it come to a point where they had to escape the house or leave it, or did it resolve eventually?
There were several times they left the house when it just became too violent. You know, they would spend weeks to a month in a hotel, and they'd check back in on the house, and the activity would have died down. They were maybe safe to come back, you know, but as soon as they would come back, it would start up all over again until finally, they got to the point where they realized, you know, we have to do something, or somebody's going to get hurt or killed if this continues to go on. And so that was when they really started kind of like reaching out to the different researchers, psychics. They found Debbie, who agreed to come and do a walkthrough of the house, and then eventually agreed to work with them to help them free themselves, free the house of the entities that were in it.
Now, that did that eventually happen, or are they still in the house? Is it everything's kind of
resolved? No. It's been about 10 years they moved out of the house. They Debbie came and did a cleansing with Matt and April and some of their family members and friends. But they were still, they were a little nervous. They held on to the house for a year before they sold it, just to make sure that, that it was safe to, you know, to do so. And they checked up on the house too, in the years that have passed.
Yeah.
To see what kind of, you know, if there's continuing activity or, you know, if it's died down. And, you know, I think thanks to Debbie's efforts, the activity has died down. There's still some stuff going on there. But the really interesting thing that they told me is that this activity only seems to flare up when a family with children moves in. Like right now, there's an elderly couple living there who basically haven't experienced anything at all. If you go back through the sales records, you know, it's like any family that moves in there that has children, they don't last more than like 3 or 4 months before they sell the place and clear out. And so it seems like this whatever was in that house is somehow somewhat focused on children, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and so now. It looks like Discovery Channel did a little document on this for a haunting and that. And did it air and everything on their show?
It aired, yeah, and I watched it. That was one of the stipulations for it to take the project, was they wanted me to watch it first. Mm-hmm. And I got to say, I love a haunting. Even though, you know, it's fine for what it is. It's a 1 hour prime time, you know, battle of good versus evil with a clean wrap up at the end.
Yeah.
you know, and that's, there's only so much you can do with that format.
Right.
And I think one of the things Matt and April wanted to do was to dig a little bit deeper into their personal experiences. Because all these shows, you know, the things we see on TV and we read, and they don't show you the trauma left behind by these experiences. You know, it's easy to watch something and just say, oh, there's some spooky ghosts, you know, in this house, but you don't really understand the mental and physical toll this takes on people. I mean, the Discovery documentary was almost 10 years ago, and after that, Matt and April, they didn't really want to talk about it, you know, because they felt that they might be, you know, ridiculed or further scrutinized and not taken seriously. And it took a while to get some of the folks to talk about their experiences. And I can understand why. You know, some of them didn't want to talk about it. Some of the people that I reached out to the husband and wife that had lived there before Matt and April, and she didn't want to talk about it, and I respect that and understand it. And even Matt was a little hesitant in the beginning, and I told him, you know, I mean, I made it pretty clear to both of them that my job is to tell your story in the best way possible, and I want to make it as entertaining as possible. I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to try and verify whether this is true or not, even though I had to by the end of it for my own sanity, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that helped a good bit. And one of the interesting things is April kind of confided in me, you know, halfway through the project, that one of the reasons that she was choosing to do this now was, it was kind of cathartic, kind of therapeutic, you know, to get Matt to talk about it again, to get everybody to talk about it again, get it out, not keep it repressed.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I guess the point being that some of the shows show up and they do their film and leave and that's it. There's no follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
It's their real life and it's their whole life, and it goes
exactly.
And it goes on after the show just like it did before.
Yeah.
And that is something that's missing. That's something that none of the shows really do, I guess. It's not the quick entertainment, but so.
Right. You know, it's not as clean as they kind of portray it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess that you can see it from that side, but it's a very good point you bring up that it's become, I think, where people just sort of watch the shows, go, oh, my God, that's really cool, and it's just out of their brain, and then the next show comes on about the same thing, and they watch that. So they're not really thinking about the people involved. They're almost characters on a show.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's not they're not personal. Like, they don't really think of April and Matt, per se, after the show. They're thinking, oh, what about those people? And that's it. They don't really... So, yeah, it's kind of a...
Yeah. That's one of the things I wanted to capture in the book was, you know, their feelings. You know, what are they feeling while this is going on? What are they thinking about? You know what I mean? And bring some real personality, you know, to the tale.
Yeah. Now, did you come up with kind of an ideology? Did you come up with some sort of a frame on this, as in what you could call it? Like, you know, there's so many expressions out there, from demon to poltergeist to, you know, like there's a thousand of them, and there's movies, and there's people, you know, vampires, and everything's going on. Did you come up with something that you thought?
For a long time now, I guess. You know, I mentioned like John Keel and some of those, you know, I guess less traditional thinkers in the realm of the paranormal these days. Personally, I think that there's something that we don't understand yet. And I like I said, I'm no expert on this. These are just, you know, my own concepts. Whatever was in this house was reacting to what it was picking up from Matt and April's subconscious. Or maybe they were projecting it out, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think there's a lot about the human mind we don't understand yet. Or, you know, there's something in the environment in it. It picked up on it and amplified it and it fed it back. But then again, whatever it is appeared to have a sentience to it, an intelligence. That was one of the, you know, I actually asked that question to Jeremy Spencer, one of the researchers who was in there. And I said, do you think these were ghosts or demons, or was it some kind of higher intelligence, like almost playing a game, or was it some kind of like projected thought form? And his response was great, because he said, all of the above, maybe. the phenomenon is so slippery. When you think you got it pegged down, it's almost like it becomes something else.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, being in the business, I find it very hard to be positive about anything. And I don't mean that in a up way, just that when people are, you know, they're calling a poltergeist this, and then they're calling it something else. And you know, everybody you talk to, they have different definitions and descriptions, and and so much of it is religious based and some of it's not. I don't know where to go with any of it, you know, really.
I'm a big proponent of the whole high strangeness theory, that it's all interrelated, maybe, you know, but we don't have, you know, there's so many different camps of study. You've got ghost hunters, Bigfoot hunters, UFO hunters, but they don't communicate with each other. They don't look at the overlap, you know what I mean, in some of these cases.
Yeah.
Where in a lot of poltergeist activity, you also have lights in the sky and vice versa. A lot of these haunted houses, people have seen strange cryptids around them as well. So I think that maybe in time science is going to bring us something new, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, we've got these fields of cognitive psychology and quantum mechanics, and that maybe they're going to show us something someday, you know, and we can be, oh yeah, you know, so that's what causes that. But it's speculation too. You know what I mean? Like the only real way to get someone to believe in these kind of things, I guess, is for them to see it themselves, you know, especially in this day and age when you give me 15 minutes in the internet and I can create, you know, any kind of ghost footage or EVP or, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No. it's easy to do and it's cheap nowadays. So
sure, yeah.
I mean, just ride through Facebook for 20 minutes and you've seen everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I will say most of it is just kind of, you know, to rile people or upset them.
Oh, sure.
But it's
sure.
pretty amazing how creative some of these people are. Like, they can really put together some stuff that's like, wow, you know, you've got talent, but it's too bad it's mm-hmm, just mm-hmm. this little
thing. You got to wonder if they're maybe doing a special effects reel for Hollywood.
Yeah, some of it's really good, and you think, wow, it's just too bad it's a little Facebook article and you're trying to piss off someone. But it's it's pretty clever. Some of it's amazing. I'm thrilled. At what people do, I'm glad of it, again, it makes it even more difficult to decide what's real.
Yeah, and I think that's why a healthy dose of skepticism is also very valuable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, we need the believers and the skeptics.
Yeah.
We need both, just to just some checks and balances.
And I think it's like a lot of things. It's hard to, but it's better to be not emotional. When you're analyzing these things, just like when you talk politics or religion or anything that.
Sure.
If it's the ones that are real emotional that just no longer listen and just scream out their thought. So nothing really changes.
Right.
You know, you're not going to change anything. So it's the same thing with this. I think that it's hard for them, for instance, Matt and April, of course, because they're involved, so emotions are... you're there.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
but,
yeah.
From the outside, you got to try and not... be as involved that way in that. So that's, but again, who knows? I'm just throwing my own two cents in. So the family's all happy now? I mean, are moved on?
They're,
resolved?
Yeah, they've gotten their lives back together and you know, they've moved on and, you know, things seem to be quiet now.
So
thankfully.
Yeah, so far. Well, so nothing followed them. Like, they moved away from the house. And they're not experiencing this all over again. This isn't something that's fault.
Not at this point. Now, Matt kind of confided in me that he thought something had followed them, you know, maybe the first house they had moved to. But at this point, everything's quiet and you know, safe. I think it might be the most important part.
Yeah.
But,
wow. And well, that's good, and no ill effects on the children. Everything seems to be okay.
Yeah, everything seems to be going pretty well. Yeah. In fact, I think her youngest actually did a book report on the book for his English class.
Well, that's probably healthy, you know, in a way. If they can talk about it and go through it, I mean, that's. So now, has this changed what you're going to do in the future? Now when this book comes out and. You're doing? Are you going to continue doing this type of research and writing, or do you? Is it kind of swung you that way, or?
Well, I guess what I'm looking at now is I don't want to know too much, not because I'm scared of it, but because I'm afraid if I know too much, there won't be any mystery left for me. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, if I've got it all figured out, then the mystery. The mystery dies a little bit, the magic dies a little. But I have a feeling I'm always going to have one foot in this arena because, I mean, the book hasn't even been officially released yet, and I've already had people coming to me and talking to me about things that they're not comfortable talking to other people about, these experiences, these phenomenon, concerns about them.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, why do you think that is? But I mean, nowadays, with so many ghost shows, like, I see UFOs still being a little bit, you know, if you start talking that you've been abducted and probed, people kind of, okay. But when you're
right,
but the ghosts have been accepted pretty. Pretty mainstream, really, haunted and ghosts and all that stuff. So why do you think people are still really scared to talk about it in that, like, for instance, with them? Why is it sort of...
It doesn't fit into their reality. It doesn't fit into their paradigm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the problem with our society is if you talk too loudly about it, you get slammed down, you know? You people start looking at you like, oh, okay, what's wrong with you? You know,
yeah.
as opposed to, well, maybe, you know, maybe something strange is going on. And I think the other thing is that maybe our definitions are a little bit too strict as well. You know what I mean? Like, we say haunting, we say ghost. Therefore, you know, in popular culture and mass media, it must be the spirit of a dead person, or it must be a demon or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're afraid to open those definitions up a little bit and say, well, maybe it's something else that we haven't considered yet. You know, maybe it's a glimpse into another reality. Maybe it's a glimpse back through time. You know, maybe it's another dimension. Maybe it's none of those things. Like I said, maybe it's something that we don't even, you know, comprehend yet.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of restrictions on how far you can take it. It's fine as entertainment, you know, like you said, and the Ghost Hunter shows and everything. But you start talking about it in personal experience too much, and that's when people start to worry about you instead of, you know, trying to understand and possibly, you know, coming to a conclusion, well, maybe that really is going on. You know.
Yeah, yeah.
But we go back to the whole thing. It's like you can't get someone to believe until they see it, until they experience it. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. If it's not in their own personal world, they might not understand it. It just just finds it. It just seems a little bit strange that it's something that's fairly mainstream, but yet at the same time, it still induces the fear to talk about it, and that's. You know, that's too bad, you know.
Yeah, it's, what did I read? There's an old quote, I can't remember who said it, but it goes something along the lines of, everybody wants to hear the ghost story, but nobody wants to see the ghost.
Yeah.
You know,
<That's>
nobody wants to be the one in the ghost story.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, it's, I think what happens is you have to question then, if someone tells you that they're having an experience in their house or at work with a haunting, then you have to challenge your own beliefs then.
Sure.
I think that might be an issue as
Definitely.
Well. Right? Because then I have to kind of go, well, this person, do I believe them? Are they nuts? Or have what I thought about ghosts and whatever, God, religion is wrong? I think that's sort of maybe sometimes...
That might actually be scarier than contemplating that, you know, ghosts are real. If you have to step back and re-examine everything you've been taught and everything you believe, everything that, you know, you've learned, that's pretty scary. That's pretty terrifying.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a big change.
Well, yeah, because the longer a belief's been in your life, you center everything on that. That's one of the many formulas you build your life on. So if you're 50 years old and then you go, wow, you mean there is such a thing as this, and then you kind of have to challenge everything you've done in 50 years.
Yeah, definitely.
I would think that would be kind of, you know, a little bit unsettling.
Definitely, yep.
So now how do people get a hold of you? Now, if someone else has a story they want to present to you, or maybe they know something about this, or they want to comment on your book, do you have a website or something? Or
I don't currently have a website. I just have a, you know, my personal email address, which is drburchill, B-U-R-C-H-I-L-L, @gmail.com.
Right. Well, it's better anyway.
Now,
websites are kind of out of date.
in this day and age. but it's... And I should make it clear, though, I'm not an expert on any of this. So.
No. I mean, this is like, it's a book you've written and stuff. It's just that sometimes, you know, people will, and you will get comments, you know, good and bad.
Yeah. You know, and actually, that, you know, that's, we're talking about writing. That's been my suggestion. I just made that suggestion to someone who came to me with, some experiences that they had, some, you know, entities that they had been seeing and phenomena that was occurring. It was all very chaotic. And I said, you know, write it. Take the chaos and make it into some kind of order, you know, because in my opinion, writing is a kind of magic as well. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
You're creating this world. You're giving it structure and form, narrative and dialogue and characters. You're making sense of it all. And I think it's also therapeutic and creative. But I mean, I suppose you could say that about any kind of art that you can bring in to deal with some kind of trauma along those lines.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a good thing to, it helps you kind of work it out in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a good thing. So not a bad thing.
Yeah.
Well, this has been certainly interesting, and, I'm glad you took the time to talk about your new book.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've enjoyed talking with you.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.